Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Early voting today in Iraq, the main vote Sunday for a new parliament. The stakes are very high this time for Iraq and the United States. We'll look at the whole picture this hour. To kick it off, we go straight to Baghdad and the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Christopher Hill. Ambassador Hill, welcome back to the show. What do you see coming on Sunday, sir, in this vote?
Well, thanks very much, Tom. Yeah, we're just, today is the day where they have so-called special needs voting, and that's mainly police and military and hospital workers, prison workers, actually hospital patients, too. They actually bring ballots to the patients at that bedside. So they estimate, that we're talking about 600,000 today. And so they've got about, something on the order of 459 polling stations, polling centers that are open. But on Sunday, that's the real event. And instead of 459 polling centers, there are 9,000 polling centers, and there's some 18.9 million registered voters. So today's a bit of a dry run for that, and we'll have to see how things are going, but so far so good.
Ambassador Hill, what's the biggest challenge you see first for Iraq here? Is it the kind of violence we've already seen in the early voting today, or are the challenges bigger than that?
Well, there's no shortage of challenges here. I would say so far, notwithstanding the incidents that your listeners have probably heard of, the fact that there were a couple of bombings in Baghdad. I think there was one hand grenade attack up in Mosul. But notwithstanding those reports, it's been a pretty quiet day so far. Now, we're still waiting to hear more from our 18 American embassy teams that are spread out around all the provinces reporting in. But so far, it's been okay. So we have to see how the violence goes and make sure it isn't a major problem. So I would say violence is an issue we focus on. I would say in terms of the things that people often worry about, fraud and that sort of thing, that there really have been very strong efforts to deal with questions of fraud. For example, the ballot paper is a very special type of paper. There's been a lot of good technical work done by the UN office here. And so I think we're going to be okay on that.
Ambassador, what would it take in the aftermath of this election, or in the election itself, to slow down the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops?
Well, look, the president about a year ago at Camp Lejeune laid out a schedule for the withdrawal of U.S. Troops, down to 50,000. And I think that's very much on schedule. But, today is an important day, not so much from the point of view of, getting our troops out, but, today is the beginning of a democratic election, which will seat a new parliament, put in a new government, and I think really help pave the way for a long-term diplomatic and kind of normal relationship that the United States would have with Iraq. So we're kind of looking at this day in terms of the quality of Iraq's democracy. And, as for the troop withdrawals, I mean, we believe they're on schedule. And, I don't want to start speculating or going into hypotheticals of what could conceivably change that.
Christopher Hill, U.S. Ambassador to Iraq. Ambassador Hill, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about Iraq's big parliamentary elections, the first since 2005, 6,000 candidates, 325 seats, Iraq's future, and America's exit in the balance. You can join the conversation. Do you see Iraq finding its feet here, finding stability, or a nation and maybe an American withdrawal still at risk? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Baghdad is Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. Anthony Shadid, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
What do you see at stake in these elections first for Iraq, Anthony?
Well, I think it's perhaps the most decisive moment for this country since the U.S. invasion back in 2003. We are seeing a political maturity out there. This is the second second official parliamentary election. There was a third one for a National Assembly. It's going to seat a new government, like Ambassador Hill mentioned. I think also it's a key indicator on what lies ahead. This is a state that is still beset by fragile institutions. There is a political, you have to rule by consensus in a country that doesn't yet have a consensus. And I think while this election is going to be important in and of itself, it also sets the stage for what is going to be a very protracted negotiation over a new government that's going to have to tackle issues that have not yet been resolved.
I don't know if you've seen it, Anthony, there in Baghdad, but the new cover of Newsweek is very striking. It's a close-up photograph of George W. Bush on the deck of the famous photo on the deck of the aircraft carrier with the mission accomplished sign in the distance behind him on the bridge there. And the big headline, Newsweek's big cover headline, is "Victory at Last, the Emergence of a Democratic Iraq." Is it time to celebrate that, Anthony?
You know, I think you have to be really careful about that. And, I for one, am kind of haunted by how we've covered elections in the past. I was here back in 2005, and I think we all understood the symbolism of that moment back in 2005. Iraqis went to the polls. They went to polls in numbers that we didn't expect. But in some ways, that second election in December 2005 set the stage for a civil war. And that civil war, raged through 2006 and 2007. There's no question that what's going to go on Sunday is a moment. It's a decisive moment, perhaps. But I think we have to be careful in overstating how stable this country is. The most decisive issues that this country faces have not been resolved. There's no indication in the past months, or no indication now, that any government is going to be able to tackle those decisive problems. We could come into a period of gridlock, a period of a confrontation between competing factions. It could be a very unsettled.
Anthony Shadid, there in Baghdad. Always a tough line. We'll look to get that back in just a moment here. And we're very grateful for him for being there. And we'll get him back with us just as soon as we can. Also with us today, and I'm happy to have him right now, you can imagine, is Ali Alawi. He's a key figure in the early years of Iraq's post-Saddam administration, a secular Shiite, held positions as Iraq's Minister of Trade, Defense, and Finance from 03 to 06. He's a nephew of Ahmad Chalabi and a cousin of Ayad Alawi, two big figures heading up opposing parties in Iraq's current election season. Ali Alawi is author of The Occupation of Iraq, Winning the War, Losing the Peace, and of The Crisis of Islamic Civilization. He's now a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University. Ali Alawi, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you've got a lot of family who are up to their necks in the election season there right now, very deeply involved in it. But let me just go to you first with the big question of what the stakes are first for Iraq in this election. What hangs on the outcome?
Well, I think, obviously there are very, very important elections, but so are the elections, I might add, of 2005 and the referendum of 2005. So the significance and importance of these elections must be put into context, and I agree with Anthony Shadid had said. Nevertheless, they are extremely important because this will be the first time, I think, in which some obvious choices are given to the electorate beyond the divisions, the ethno-sectarian divisions that dominated the 2005 elections.
Well, let's talk about that. In the 2005 elections, people just voted for one big list. They didn't even know necessarily who the individuals were. They just knew the parties. There was some fear that if the individual candidates were named, they would be targets for terrorism, assassination even. This time, it's much more transparent. People are and can vote for individuals. Am I not right?
Well, you're right in the sense that in 2005, the so-called party lists and the party leaders allocated the seats, and if you were high up in the list, you would have a greater chance of being elected. But the terms, as it were, of the 2005 elections were more to do with the broad distribution of power between the various communities in Iraq, and it was really immaterial who the individual candidates were. People voted really to see what kind of broad confirmation that they wanted to give to Iraq's ethno-sectarian composition.
And this time, is it still a struggle for power between Sunni, Shiite, Kurds?
I think this hasn't gone away. I mean, there are attempts to create broader coalitions that focus on issues, but they are more like cobbling together sectarian or ethno-sectarian groups into broader coalitions. It's not really the beginning of a new secular liberal politics, as it were. So it's not so much old wine in new bottles, but it's not really far from that. I still believe that sectarian and ethnic considerations will figure most importantly in the way that voters would cast their vote. But of course, individuals also matter. So now people have a choice between the kind of candidates that they want to see in parliament within the ethno-sectarian composition of the party lists.
Are you worried about the aftermath of this election, bringing back chaos, violence that we've all seen far too much of in recent years, or not?
Well, I'm not too sanguine about it. I think, yes, there's a serious risk that we would get a kind of prolonged deadlock and prolonged jockeying for positions between the leading candidates to become Prime Minister and President and Speaker of Parliament. And if these are not satisfactorily resolved and the issues are not transcended, or the conflict between them is not transcended, it is likely to break out into violence. But I doubt if we'll get the violence that we had in 2005 to 2007. And elections in Iraq now may not necessarily bring the kind of stable political landscape that we all expect. It might be the obvious the other way around, but the odds would seem to me to be in favor of greater rather than lesser stability, but the risks of instability are really there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iraq on the cusp of big elections as America eyes the exits. Joining us today, Ali Alawi, former Minister of Trade, of Defense, of Finance in Iraq between 2003 and 2006, secular Shiite. Also with us in just a moment again from Baghdad, we'll have Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. Iraqis themselves, with doubts, hopes, mixed feelings about the candidates running in this Sunday's elections, here are some Iraqi views called by the Arab news service Al Jazeera.
I want the candidates to implement their promises as fast as they hang their posters. I really wish they would implement what they say.
We only see the candidates in election days and on posters.
The old faces will be gone. There are new faces, and God willing, they will rule Iraq and will change the current situation.
Hopes and fears in Iraq. We'll go to Anthony Shadid and Ali Alawi. Let's get Adam in here first from Tupper Lake, New York. Adam, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What do you know?
Well, I was a soldier in the United States Army for 2 years. I did not serve in Iraq, but I lost at least 3 close friends in Iraq. And I think the fact that our presence there has given them the ability to even have a democratic election is a huge deal in itself. And I think that the human cost and the financial burden that this war has put on our country, whether these elections bring violence or not, I think it's time for us to pull out. And I really hope that this doesn't, that if there is violence, that it doesn't stop us from pulling out when we're supposed to.
Adam, we've got it. I appreciate your call. We'll take it straight to Anthony Shadid in Baghdad. Anthony, I saw in your newspaper last week the vice president looking down the road and saying, you know, yes, we're pulling out combat troops, but he said we're not leaving behind cooks and quartermasters. He said there will still be guys who can shoot straight and go get bad guys. So what is anticipated here? What's the best and worst case scenario for the U.S. in the aftermath, Anthony?
You know, I don't think there's any question that the Obama administration has signaled that this is not its war. But you're right. There are still going to be 50,000 troops through next year. There's still a very formidable U.S. presence. It's the biggest American embassy anywhere in the world. So, you know, the suggestion that the Americans are somehow leaving isn't the case. There is still a big military presence. There still is a big diplomatic presence. But the withdrawal, I think, is inevitable. And I think sort of, you know, an Iranian invasion of the country, the Americans aren't going to be coming back in big numbers, the opposite. The caller makes an interesting point, and I think it's a compelling one. And I think it's something that we have to often think about as we look forward. You know, elections, the Americans have proven very successful at helping organize elections here. There have been 5 elections so far. They've run relatively well. But we have to remember that elections often exacerbate divisions rather than bridge them. And I think just like Ali Alawi was saying earlier, that's what we're looking forward to. The elections are one thing. What the elections result, the results of those elections is another.
We've got more questions on exactly that front. Adam, thanks for your call. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I'm not all that knowledgeable in the Middle East. I'm kind of just your average guy on the street who's listening to NPR on the way to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, I continue to hear about the bombings in Baghdad and the fact that there really hasn't been peace in the Middle East for 2,000 years. And I'm just not really seeing these elections making any difference.
Making a difference. Well, let's look at it, Jim. Ali Alawi, is something new emerging here? I don't know if you've seen the Newsweek cover "Victory at Last," the emergence of Democratic Iraq. They're saying, "Look, it's time to give credit where credit's due. A lot has come along here. Iraq's come a long way." Newsweek, at least, is saying. Our caller's skeptical. Do you see the possibility of something new, firm, real emerging here in terms of a kind of democracy in the Middle East we haven't seen before?
Well, I think the signs are really, they're not overwhelmingly positive, but they're there. But the main issue still remains whether we're seeing the beginning of a political process that will change and transform the Iraqi landscape, the political landscape, or it's a kind of mirage. The glass is, it's not a question whether the glass is half full or half empty. I think the glass is probably about 30% full.
Mm-hmm.
So, but still, there are, I think, good signs. There are good indications that at least the main political figures are accepting the rules of, democratic procedures as being, to some extent, binding on them. But this is really different from developing some political culture that is rooted in democratic practice. This is, I think, we're very, very far away from that. But as long as the main political actors have a kind of rule book that will guide their way that they negotiate and navigate these problems between themselves, it may not spill over into violence. The main risk that we run in Iraq, I think, is not so much abandoning elections as a way of sorting out political power,
mm-hmm.
but it is more to do with creating a political class that then dominates the political process, really to the exclusion of other groups, as we have in other so-called democracies in the Middle East. Lebanon, for example, is a democratic state, but it's dominated by a political clique that circulates power within itself. So it may be a way station to a political structure that only serves the interests of those who are able to use it and manipulate it, leaving the bulk of the population as onlookers, except every 4 years during elections.
Tony Shadid, in Baghdad, you have pointed to Lebanon as a kind of warning case of factionalism that never leads to a good stability. What about that? Outline, if you would, for us, Tony. What are the main parties and factions, grappling for power in these elections? And is there an outcome that looks more like stability and one that looks more like trouble? Or what about Ali Alawi's fear of, a new sort of dominant political class in power?
I think when you look at the landscape right now, there are several groups that you can point to. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki.
Tony, it's a tough line there. Ali Alawi, I'll put the same question to you. Tony was just going to the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Is it clear, for starters, that he will stay in power? You've got some pretty powerful relatives who would like to take his place.
Well, the polls really show all kinds of outcomes, depending on who's giving them. But by and large, I would probably think that he will gain a plurality, but certainly not a majority, and certainly not enough to be able to dominate the political scene. There are other people who are trying to unseat him, including those who are his erstwhile allies. So, the situation is fraught by, as it were, elephants fighting for control of the patch. But all else being equal, I think it is probable that his group will get the largest number of seats, but certainly not enough in any shape or form to be able to form the government without very, very elaborate and complex deal brokering.
So, do you think the country is closer to figuring out how to incorporate Sunnis into the power structure? Of course, they were the minority that ruled under Saddam Hussein. Your uncle, Ahmed Chalabi, had raised a lot of controversy recently when he struck a lot of them from the electoral rolls, kicked them out of the election. Do you see this election holding open the possibility of a Sunni place in the power structure that's manageable and sufficient to win, you know, Sunni cooperation in Iraq's government?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put the question this way. It is
okay.
the main problem, as I see it, in Iraq is really that those who were in power before before 2003, you can call them Sunnis, you can call them Ba'athis, you can call it those who were part of a certain power structure that continued in control for over two or three decades. This group, and it's quite a large group, has not, in my opinion, completely reconciled to the changes that have taken place as a result of the American intervention in Iraq. So unless and until these people accept that the way, as it were, to returning the situation to where it was before is blocked, and they have to come to terms with a new political order, then I think there will always be a main stumbling block here in trying to incorporate the significant number of people who feel excluded from the political process. On the other side, you have those who feel disempowered and disenfranchised in the past are now in some ways over-grabbing and overcompensating for their disempowerment. And there's a sense of entitlement on the part of those who are in the opposition, those who were disempowered and disenfranchised as to what the government or the state owes them. And these two issues, in my mind...
But that would be the Shiites in general you're talking about, but also Kurds.
Yes, mm-hmm. Generally the Shiites and generally the Kurds. The Kurds have really sorted out their problems within themselves because they have basically have a geographic space
right. In
which the central government is not involved. And their issues are between them and the rest of the country rather than inside their own political system. And there are conflicts inside their system, but it's not sufficient to break, as it were, the united front that they have. This, to me, is the main issue in Iraq, and that is not yet resolved.
Tony Shadid, in Baghdad, do you think Iraq is working closer through the polls, maybe elsewise, to figuring out how to accommodate the Sunnis who once, you know, had the stark upper hand here and then went into a period where they were kicked out, de-Ba'athification, boycotted the polls? Do you see a balance emerging in these elections that looks workable?
You know, I think there are the gestures toward bringing everyone into the tent. I mean, you know, there is Sunni participation in parliament, obviously, in the security services. But I think when you ask the question, is there real power sharing? That's not the case. And if anything is, if there's anything that is very remarkable about Prime Minister Maliki's tenure, it's that he has concentrated power in the hands of a close knit group of advisors around him, predominantly from the Dawa Party, his own party. And you don't really see any, I think, cross-sectarian or cross-ethnic participation in that central arena of power. That may not necessarily change. I mean, I think there still is a political culture that exists in Iraq that views politics as a zero-sum game. There's a victor and a vanquished. And I think we're still seeing that, that equation predominate here.
Tony, what about the neighbors? Reading in the German magazine Der Spiegel, they're looking at Ali Alawi's relatives here, Ayad Alawi and Ahmed Chalabi, saying Chalabi's grown very close to Iran, kind of represents, in some degree, Iran's very large interest in the outcome in Iraq, that Ayad Alawi has gone around the Sunni Arab nations saying, look, we want to get back into the Arab system, not the Persian, not the Iranian. What about the neighbors and their interest and role in the election season, Tony?
You know, I think we have to be careful about seeing Ahmed Chalabi as too much of Iran. Ahmed Chalabi, has a remarkable ability of self-preservation and an ability to further his own interests, and I think Iran fits in that type of scenario. It's convenient for him to be close to Iran at this point. I think what you mentioned about Ayad Alawi, though, is interesting. I mean, he is, you know, his visits, his conversations, his political rhetoric does suggest that he sees Iraq's future, you know, perhaps more squarely in the Sunni Arab region, better relations with countries like Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the rest of the Gulf, with its extensive resources. You know, where Iraq fits into the landscape is a question. As long as it remains relatively weak, you're going to see serious intervention here, and you do see intervention by Iran. Less so perhaps by Saudi Arabia and Syria, But it is still there. And I think as long as that weakness persists, you're going to see other countries, you know, believe they can have a say in the way politics here evolves.
Let's get a call from Boston. Abdullah. Abdullah, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question. I think the wall understood that the beginning of the war, the way that is it was waged the war was illegal, and people who have walked on their way like Ahmed Jalabi seems to be the winning people who are using the election and the sectarian divide. And I was wondering how can be characterized as a democracy going forward when you have polarization as high as it is right now, and where certain divide of people are being denied or being called as the people who used to rule the country when they, you know, and just my question is that how going forward can be called this a democracy when the pretext of the war was illegal, as we know, and the people who have used the war, as Ahmed Jalabi seems to be in his group, are gaining ground and getting the election there.
Ali Alawi, you've spoken to this somewhat, but you hear Abdullah's remaining skepticism. How do you respond?
Well, I think this is a common refrain by those who obviously are unhappy about what happened after 2003, is that, you know, everything that is built upon an illegal act, which the U.S. invasion may have been, is necessarily illegal. But I think this is really ignoring that there have been major political developments in the country, and you can't really overturn a political system simply because its origin 7 years ago was based on a possibly unacceptable act under international law. The fact of the matter is that we have a political system, we have a constitution, and it seems that the majority, if not the vast majority of the people, want to work within the institutional forms that this constitution presents, except those who want to overthrow it. The fact that certain groups are now building up their political power as a result of sectarian arguments and sectarian rallying points or rallying cries, it doesn't alter the fact that sectarian considerations are an important factor in Iraqi politics. In fact, they're a critical factor. So you can bury your head in the sand and say that, you know, all Iraqis are the same, and therefore they should not, politicians should not use these extremely sensitive and controversial identities to push their political agenda. But the reality is that this is the nature of the country, and the only way that you can transcend this as if there's a commonality of interest that recognizes that the past state, the past governments that ran Iraq were in many ways discriminatory and oppressive, and the structures that are being put in place may very well tend to a kind of dictatorship of the majority. Unless this is taken into account, I think it will be a zero-sum game.
Tony, we've just got half a minute before a break here, but what portion of Iraqis do you think in this election might be willing to vote outside their faction, whether Sunni or Shia or Kurd? Is there a new sort of pan-factional, secular view of politics yet, or not so much?
You know, there really isn't. There's two coalitions that you know, make a stab at being a secular coalition, but I think in the end they're going to draw most of their support from, you know, on a sectarian basis, not the Sunni support. You know, I think one point just to remember through this is that, you know, there is an election culture in Iraq, and that's indisputable. Are there the democratic institutions, stable democratic institutions, that are viable enough to support the results of those elections? And I think that's a question that hasn't been answered yet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at Iraq on the cusp of big elections as America eyes the exits. Let's hear a little bit of what people have been up against there. News again today of bombings around polling stations in early voting there. Here's one man identified by Reuters as a National Trend Bloc supporter telling reporters he'll still vote despite the danger.
We have condemned this cowardly and terrorist act. Such acts will never thwart our determination to participate in the vote. God willing, we are determined to take part in the upcoming elections.
And how will Iraqi votes? Here's Ayad al-Samari, a Sunni Arab, Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament, says he believes Iraqis will still vote, as Ali Alawi is saying, perhaps, along sectarian lines. Here he is in a clip from NPR yesterday.
people will vote according to loyalty rather than to programs. And when we reach to a point that the people will vote for programs, then we can see there is no sectarian behavior affecting the election.
You can join our conversation this hour with Anthony Shadid, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the New York Times. And we're joined today by Ali Alawi. He has served as Minister of Trade, of Defense, of Finance for Iraq between 2003 and 2006. He's watching everything going on there right now. A secular Shiite joining us. Let's get a call from Jack in Chester, Vermont. Jack, you're on the air.
Hello. Tom, it's all about the oil. The fact of the matter is, Forbes magazine said on January 25th there's 51 billion barrels of oil there. British Petroleum has estimated 100 billion. And in Kuwait, we still have a large military presence, so I suspect many of those troops will just move over to Kuwait. We will protect our vital interest in Iraq, which, of course, is oil. It's all about the oil.
Let us pick it up. Anthony Shadid, let me come first to you on that. You know, how far will American guns get from these oil fields? How soon?
You know, I think it is a question. There is some skepticism out there that the Americans will leave by the deadline that was set out in the Special Forces Agreement back in 2008. There may be some renegotiation. There have been rumors that, they're hoping a new government will be seated so that they can renegotiate parts of that agreement. But I do want to stress that there is the Americans' posture here has changed. It's indisputable. There has already been a withdrawal down to, a little below 100,000 troops. The diplomatic presence it orients itself different rather than, the somewhat imperious way they used to act back in 2003 and 2004. The ambassador acknowledges, very bluntly that, he has influence, but his influence is not limited necessarily, but it's not sweeping. And often this is a diplomatic task to get what the Americans want. So, oil is incredibly important here. It's incredibly important to the future. The Americans are going to have a strategic interest here for a long time, as are the Iranians, as are neighbors like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, and Turkey. But it is a different landscape, I think, in terms of American power in and of itself.
Ali Alawi, what about the sharing of the oil wealth, oil revenues among Iraqis themselves? The parliament has accomplished, maybe 50 pieces of legislation in the last year or so, but they still have not voted on an effective oil revenue sharing plan. How big a problem is that at this point for the country?
Well, it's a big problem because I think Iraq really suffers from the so-called oil disease, which is that a huge oil revenues that are concentrated in the central government end up being abused, misused, misappropriated, and often stolen through all kinds of corrupt practices. And this was a situation that has been prevailing in Iraq now for a few years and appears to be continuing unabated. Iraq is a rich state with very poor people. The transfer of resources from the central government to the regions and the provinces is taking place, but apart from the Kurds who get an off the top 17% of the oil revenues, it flows to the other provinces in a very erratic and inconsistent way. Nevertheless, it is one of the great, I think, tragedies in the country is that there has been no attempt to transfer resources directly from the oil revenues to the public in the form of some kind of income transfer. How it's done is through the government providing free or nearly free food and electricity and so on, and in the process encouraging and indulging in huge amounts of misappropriation and corruption. So oil is a curse so far. It can be a blessing if it's used properly. I mean, they use oil revenues properly in Norway, but in the case of Iraq and most other oil-producing countries, it has been abused by a political class that seems to have a sense of entitlement to it.
And what about foreign interests in Iraq's oil? American interests, for that matter, our caller Jack asks about. How do you see that playing out? Do you believe that you'll see continued withdrawal of foreign, military power from overhanging Iraq? Or is that inevitable given what a large reserve your country has?
Well, I mean, the oil side of it really is quite complex. You can't make a straightforward argument that the United States invaded and occupied Iraq in order to gain control of the oil. I mean, the amount of funds that the treasure and blood that the U.S. has expended is much, much greater than the production of oil of Iraq for the next 50 years. If the U.S. gets Iraq's oil free for the next 50 years, it's probably not pay for the, you know, $2 trillion odd that has been expended on this war. But there is obviously a desire to control the quantity and flow of oil, given that it is such a crucial and strategic commodity. And I think for the next 20 years, we will still be in an oil-dependent era. And U.S. control over the resource, not necessarily through control over the oil fields, it can be done in other ways, is obviously a very important strategic factor. But one of the things I'd like to point out is that in the recent oil service agreements, a number of oil service contracts, very, very important ones, were awarded in the last few months. Only one went to an American-led consortium, which seems to put the lie to the argument that the United States wants to dominate the oil sector by pushing the interest of American oil companies. The Chinese have won more contracts, even the Russians, the French, the Italians, the British. So it's not all the way it seems to be to those who oppose the war in the early days. It's not only about oil.
Well, American blood and Iraqi and a lot of other people's oil once they bought it. Kahin in Nashville. Kahin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is for your specialist. Basically, I want to know how they feel about letting all of us ex-Iraqi patriots participate in these elections. You know, all of us Kurds. I'm a Kurd. I'm a very proud Kurd. And now I'm going to be voting for someone, you know, that is Kurdish and is in favor of, you know, Kurdish politics and what the Kurds need. But basically, I just want to know how they feel, you know, are our votes valid in deciding what's best for these people that are actually living in the country and living in this environment?
Kahin, may I ask you, so you're an Iraqi Kurd. Are you voting from the United States? Can you vote from abroad? Are you a full participant?
Yes, I'm voting in Nashville, actually. There's going to be polling stations this weekend.
Wow. And thinking about the role of the expatriates, Tony Shadid, let me put that first to you. There are millions in total, if you include refugees. What about that vote in the overall political equation in Iraq?
Well, I think the vote, it's probably going to buttress the results that we're going to see in the provinces. It was rearranged a little bit how those votes would be counted during the debates over the election law back in December. So it's a little bit indeterminate how big of an impact it will actually have on the seats themselves, since those votes will be counted in the respective provinces where these refugees came from. You know, the caller makes an interesting point, though. And again, I think it's an important point to make, which is, again, elections have gone quite remarkably well here. The governments that have followed have operated by necessity on consensus. You have to have consensus in order for the sake of stability. You know, without consensus, some party is going to bolt and the government, you know, will be paralyzed. But that same consensus, I think, is mitigated against good government. You know, these governments have proven that they can hold elections, and these elections have gone off well. But I don't think any government yet has proven that it can govern effectively. And part of that problem is this notion of consensus and trying to forge consensus in a country that simply doesn't have it right now.
So what is it going to take, if that leaves Iraq vulnerable but also facing opportunity here, what would it take to throw the U.S. off its withdrawal schedule, Tony? We saw General Odierno, top U.S. military commander there, saying that they have contingency plans that would keep a combat brigade in northern Iraq beyond the September 1st deadline for combat troops out if necessary. What kind of development might necessitate that on the other side of these elections?
To be honest, I think it would have to be something quite dramatic for the United States to change plans on its withdrawal. It's become a political issue, and like so much in Iraq over the past 7 years, events here are dictated often by domestic American considerations. And what you're dealing with is a midterm election coming up in the United States, and for the Obama administration to reverse course and say they're going to keep troops here or even increase troops, I think would be politically untenable. I think it's regrettable that American domestic considerations often play out in Iraq. In some ways, I think the withdrawal, perhaps, you know, you often hear this, that the withdrawal is too hasty, it's coming at an inopportune time when institutions are still so weak here. But I think the idea of the Americans somehow changing those withdrawal plans would be very surprising.
Ali Alawi, what's your view here? There's a political, requirement back in the States, but there are realities on the ground in Iraq as well. How do you see the American withdrawal schedule intersecting with Iraq's realities? Is it the right schedule from the Iraqi point of view, from your point of view?
I think so, yes. I mean, withdrawal of the American troops now is, the American troops are no longer really needed to, as it were, to stabilize the situation at a minimum level to allow political life to continue. I think this was achieved perhaps last year. There may be there are two factors, I think, that may lead to a political reconsideration. One of them is the extension and expansion of Iranian power in Iraq by through the election of what seemed to be a very pro-Iranian government. This may lead to an escalation of violence and the ranging of sort of the relaunching of a low-level insurgency. This may, although I don't think it will, but this may be a factor that will make America pause. The other factor is, which is even more unlikely, I think, is the rise of a kind of Al-Qaeda base again in Iraq. I mean, Al-Qaeda in Iraq has nothing to do with the one in Afghanistan. And it is that, I think, is also improbable. So, I mean, politically, I can't see anything on the horizon that makes it imminent that the U.S. will reconsider its decision. However, I think the military wants to maintain some kind of long-term bases in Iraq as part of the American strategic military posture, as it were, in the Middle East. Whether the military can overcome the political issues here in Washington, I don't know. But I think they've made it clear that they don't want to just withdraw completely from Iraq. They may want to keep quite a sizable air base, perhaps, as part of the sort of the map of American bases in the greater Middle East.
Do you see Iraq being prepared to accept that?
I think no government can survive in the medium term if they accept that. In the short term, they may have to go along with it. But if there is a large American military presence, even though if it's over the horizon and it's not involved domestically, but it's part of a larger American strategic posture in the area, it will be a very, very tough thing to swallow. And I think it will be a cause of long-term friction and long-term instability. And few Iraqi governments can live by that.
Let's get a call from Abdi in Boston. Abdi, you're on the air.
Yes, I strongly believe that Iraq, no matter what you do, is occupied illegally. The fact that President recently himself said that if you put a makeup on the pig, doesn't make that, you know, something else.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, that's going to be considered occupied illegally, and until we deoccupy it, I don't expect any changes.
Are you Iraqi, Abdi, or are you from the region? What's your interest here?
Well, my interest is, yes, I am from the region. My interest is that we have problems. I mean, if yesterday was Iraq occupation, we can think of occupying Iran next, and after that, Venezuela maybe, because they're not acting good. So we need different world order to deal with this problem rather than think that occupying a country and putting makeup on it and make it look like democratic, that will solve the problem.
Are you from Iran, Abdi? Are you Iranian?
I am. Yes, I am.
Do you think Iran might be a kind of, too much foreign influence in Iraq ultimately? Will Iran try to run the country?
But I'm worrying about the world as a whole, then different countries. If we have some kind of order in the world, if we don't make countries buy weapons and get charged, and then we know Ambassador Gillespie's story in Iraq that made, encouraged Saddam Hussein to occupy Kuwait. So, you know, there are a lot of exterior movements. But after all, if you consider Iraq the way it happened, it really was the influence of the right wing in America combined with the Zionists that shook hands with them and made the Iraq occupation possible and changed people of America's mind.
Abdi, our time is short. I want to go to Ali Alawi. Mr. Alawi, do you see Iraqis in general still seeing themselves as an occupied country? Would they still feel that way when so-called combat troops are out, but there are still tens of thousands of other American military there for a while?
Yes, I mean, a significant number of Iraqis think that in spite of what has happened in terms of increasing the authority and sovereignty of the country is still very, very dependent on the American security, economic, and political, and diplomatic umbrella, and therefore, in some ways, its sovereignty is diminished. There's a smaller number of people who think that, irrespective of what kind of governments, the constitution, or whatnot emerges, the fact is that the initial act was illegal, and therefore, it detracts from the sovereignty of the country. I think it is a body of opinion but it seems to be shrinking with time. And I think over time we can't keep on going revisiting the conflicts and the issues of 2002 and 2003, and then claim because ultimately we still have to go through an electoral process. We still have to go through a constitutional process, and it won't be much different from the ones that has transpired recently. So. I don't buy that argument. I'm afraid that the fact that the original act was not, but the degree of U.S. Influence and the degree of U.S. Control over certain aspects of Iraq's sovereignty, including, for example, control over the airspace, is great with the Iraqis. Mm.
Into all that history comes the election. Tony Shadid in Baghdad, you've just got 10 seconds. Do you expect more violence at the polls? Tony, a lot already, apparently.
Yeah, I think there will probably be more violence, but it's hard to see that it disrupts the vote itself.
Well, and so on it goes. With all that history behind it and the future, we shall see. Anthony Shadid with the New York Times in Baghdad, thank you very much for being with us today. And Ali Alawi, former Trade, Defense, and Finance Minister of Iraq, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.